Hey everyone, you're listening to the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast with fiction author and national security expert Natasha Bajma. Join me as I interview subject matter experts about weapons of mass destruction and emerging technologies and authors who write about them. We'll discuss the ethical, societal, and technical aspects of science and technology so that you can tell great stories and still get the details right. Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 5 of the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast. My name is Natasha Bajma, aka WMD Girl on Twitter. I'm a fiction author, national security expert, and your host for this podcast. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome to the show. I started this podcast to help authors write great stories while getting the technical details right. So if you're interested in science and technology, in reading good fiction, or want to write fiction based on technology, you're in the right place. Before we get started, just a few notes. The views expressed on this podcast are my own and do not reflect the official policy or position of the National Defense University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. The Authors of Mass Destruction podcast is proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Check us out at www.authorsontheair.com. Okay, let's talk tech news. So this week's headline is How Swarming Drones Will Change Warfare, published on BBC News on March 16. The swarms are coming. In February, British Defense Secretary announced that British Armed Forces would deploy swarm squadrons in several years. The US has also been testing interconnected cooperative drones that are capable of working together to overwhelm adversaries. The Defense Advanced Research Project, DARPA, for example, has been working on a program they called Gremlins. These are micro drones, the size and shape of missiles, so not quite so micro, designed to be dropped from planes and perform reconnaissance over vast areas. I think it goes without saying that the use of drone swarms on the battlefield will change the nature of warfare. These are low-cost, intelligent, and inspired by swarms of insects. These new machines are going to revolutionize future conflict. And the key difference here is their ability to self-organize. These types of drones would be capable of making and coordinating decisions. And with this level of autonomy, drones will be able to respond at machine speed. What that means is they'll be able to respond a lot more quickly than humans would. So human decision-making takes more time than a machine would take to make decisions. In a related and also fascinating project, DARPA recently began soliciting ideas on how to build computing systems as small and efficient as the brains of insects. This is called the Microscale Biomimetic Robust Artificial Intelligence Networks Program, or MicroBrain, gotta love the acronym. The idea here is to develop artificial intelligence systems that simulate insect brains, so they are trained on less data and they operate with less energy. And it makes sense to start with simple. So many machine learning tools based on the deep neural networks of the human brain are extremely complex, but perhaps we can make more advances by starting out simple. Okay, let's get to the interview. Today I'm talking to Nathan Goodman, a USA Today best-selling author of a thriller series featuring a small, strong female protagonist. Her name is Special Agent Jana Baker, and his books deal with several scenarios involving nuclear weapons. Thanks for tuning in to Authors of Mass Destruction podcast. I'm pleased to have USA Today best-selling thriller writer Nathan Goodman with me. Nate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me, Natasha. This is great.
So I thought first we would just have you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, your background, your interests, and what you're doing as an author.
Oh, for sure. So I have been an author for about 5 years now. I grew up in the southeastern United States. Like a lot of people, went off and did something really different professionally than my major. But as far as what I like to do, besides writing, because writing is clearly one of those things that just is always popping into my head, I love the outdoors. I'm always looking to go either hiking or camping or something like that. Visit the family to the beach. I'm a husband and a father of two daughters, and we have a dog, and the dog is also a female. So I'm a little outnumbered here.
I see that.
And you actually are writing a series with a strong female character as well.
Right, that's correct. The Special Agent Jana Baker spy thriller series features a strong female heroine, and that was definitely something I did on purpose. My kids were young, 10, 12 year olds at the time when I started, and I just thought, you know, on top of their mother, who's a very strong woman, what about showing them, giving them another character, giving them something that they could look up to in terms of a strong female role model. So that's really been fun for me to be able to provide for them.
You mentioned on your website that you also, so Special Agent Jana Baker is in the FBI, and she's in a male-dominated world, and you are showing her overcoming difficulties in that world. How do you make sure you get that right?
That's always somewhat hard, but having a wife who is been heavily involved in the corporate world for so many years, she sees some of those struggles on a day-to-day basis. I've also got one friend who is a female FBI agent. She's retired now, but so she could give me a little bit of those hints and those insights as to, you know, what may be different about being a female in the FBI versus a male.
Okay, yeah, because I read a series, a thriller series, thriller mystery series, and my protagonist is female. I don't know if I would venture out and try to write a male. So I really applaud you on that effort. It's very brave.
It's a little scary because I was scared that I would get it wrong and that readers would lash back at me. Fortunately, it seems to work out just fine. So.
Well, that's great. So when you're writing a thriller series, you can choose any number of agencies to have your main character work at, like the CIA. Why did you choose the FBI in particular?
That's a great question. I had, like I said, I had that one friend who is an agent, and I had the privilege, my wife and I, to go up to the FBI Academy at Quantico to watch her graduate. And that was a lot of fun. We got to watch that happen. We got to be on campus. We got to see the things that they do. And that was almost, it wasn't that many years after the movie The Silence of the Lambs had come out. And you're in that movie, you're watching things at the FBI Academy, and we're walking into those rooms. And things like that were a lot of fun. So I like the connection there.
Do you, are you in touch with folks at the FBI to make sure you get those technical details right?
I've got a couple of people who are either a current agent or recently retired who can at least, you know, correct me on a few things. Sometimes the way the FBI might actually go about an investigation, to be honest, isn't that exciting. And so you may find in my book, if you were an FBI agent, that I'm telling it a little bit differently than the way they would really do it. Or maybe it takes much longer to get these things to happen. But you know, it's a thriller novel. I get to make the rules, which is fun.
That's true. Life is boring, right? I'm sure most days working as an FBI special agent are not that exciting, thank goodness. I don't know if you've ever been to Thriller Fest. They have an FBI workshop every year. I attended, I think, 2 years ago, and it was really great. So if you're interested, something to look up.
That would be great, right? Yeah.
So let's talk about your series. It's a spy thriller series. What sort of themes do you address in the series?
Well, on top of, you know, what you're really doing is you're following Jana through her trials and tribulations. We're bringing in a lot of the challenges she faces as an agent and a lot of the dangers, and bringing in this theme of terrorism. So there's a lot of these books relate to, in some way or another, relate to a terrorist plot. And she's working on those cases. And early in the series, she becomes the lead investigator on a case that involves a terrorist that has his hands on a nuclear weapon. And this terrorist starts to haunt her throughout the series. And so she is constantly fighting against him and going through some of the really hard, stressful situations that even bring about post-traumatic stress disorder, and her having to deal with that as well.
So you mentioned the terrorist getting his hands on a nuke. Is that in Protocol 15? Is that the first book where you address the nuke issue?
The first one was in the 14th Protocol, which is right before.
Okay.
Protocol 15. So that was the first instance of it. But in Protocol 15, he had come off, the terrorist had come off the a problem that he ran into in the first book, and then gets his hands on a different nuclear weapon, and the whole nightmare for Janna begins again.
Okay, so let's talk about the different scenarios without giving too many spoilers, but if you can, how does your terrorist gain access to nuclear weapons, and did you use different scenarios in the different books?
Yeah, there were definitely different scenarios, but in the book Protocol 15, it's a very complex setup that happens where the terrorist orchestrates his access weapon. And this weapon is, through a huge series of events, is brought into his hands, and it happened to be the warhead section of a large intercontinental ballistic missile. So they've separated the warhead from the missile, and he's got an expert with him who can take that warhead and open it up into its 10 independent parts. And so now he's got his hands on 10 independent nuclear weapons, and takes some of those and sells a bunch of them to the highest bidder, because he doesn't need them all. He only needs a couple for his own, but now he's funding his terrorist activities for the next many years. And he's got some significant nefarious plots that he wants to pull off with the ones he keeps.
So 10 warheads, that sounds like a Satan missile from SS-18 from the Soviet Union. Is that what you chose?
That was, it starts out aboard a Russian sub that been decommissioned. Mm-hmm. The sub, you know, in real life, I went and looked this up. I found a decommissioned Russian sub, a boomer, and this boat had supposedly been scrapped. And in my book, secretly, the boat was sold to the Pakistani Navy. And so the Pakistanis have been using it to defend the border. And the terrorist sabotages the submarine to cause it to go down, and they're able to extract one of the weapons with a ship and some other instruments overhead. And so that's how they kind of get their hands on it. So this nuclear weapon, it's not even supposed to exist either. The sub was really supposed to have been destroyed along with all the weapons, and that was part of the NATO treaty, but secretly the Russians had sold it, and that's where he gets his hands on it.
All right. Very complex. Because, I mean, one of the challenges for terrorists gaining access to nuclear weapons is it's really difficult for them to make one themselves. It's really almost a near impossibility for terrorists to produce the fissile material that they would need for a weapon. And so going to an existing source, one of the existing nuclear weapon states like the Soviet Union, like Pakistan, like North Korea, would be a viable option. I also noticed that you have North Korea launching a missile on Hawaii. Is that in Protocol?
Right. Right. And it's a little bit surreal because at the time I wrote the book, we did have a lot of tension with North Korea, but it was nothing like it is today. There was no blustering. We weren't afraid they were about to launch on us. And I wrote the book, and it was only a few months later that, you know, the whole situation in real life started to get very scary. But in the book, the North Koreans launch an intercontinental ballistic missile on Hawaii, and it happens in the middle of the night on purpose so that the American public wouldn't see it. No one would know about it. The weapon hits an island, only there's no warhead on the missile. And this is, in essence, the North Koreans telling the United States, we can get you, we can reach you, don't threaten us because we'll do it for real. And they've accurately launched a missile and scared us to death.
So in the book, you don't have the U.S. responding in any sort of way because we don't know about it?
It happens. And I did all the calculations. I looked at all the flight times and things like that from a North Korean launch to how long would it take to hit Hawaii. And it's a matter of just a few minutes. It's a really quick time frame. So we did not respond with an actual launch back, but since the weapon didn't detonate, it wasn't live. No one really knows about it except for people in the government, and the president decides that something has to be done here. We have got to do something, but he can't do it publicly because we didn't really get attacked exactly. So he goes about his own nefarious means of trying to get back at them in a very strong response.
That's interesting. You know, people don't often think about, we think about ballistic missiles reaching the continental United States in 30 minutes, but Hawaii is a lot closer to North Korea than even the West Coast. So you're right, it wouldn't take very long. In fact, did you hear about the Hawaii alert, the false alert that happened, I think just last year?
Right, yeah, scared everybody to death, right.
I think they had 15 minutes to get their families to safety.
And, you know, unfortunately, where is safety? That would be so frightening.
Yeah. So you obviously are dealing with nuclear weapons in your plots, like three books in your series?
Right. Three of the books deal
so
with it.
Why nuclear weapons? I mean, what's so fascinating?
You know, I think on top of the obvious that everyone would be afraid of such a thing, which makes for a very exciting thriller, I think really it kind of goes back to growing up, because I grew up in a time when, you know, we were always afraid of the Russians. It was a big deal. A Cold War went on forever and there was always tension. And, you know, you go back and look just a little bit of history. You start with the Cuban Missile Crisis and how afraid the United States was. And then that just went on for years and years. We were always afraid of what would happen if. Then you had the breakup of the Soviet Union. And so that always brings up those questions of, okay, do they have all those weapons? Are they all secure? And so then it just made me think more and more about using that type of plot in my novels.
It's interesting that you say that, because current generations, and I think millennials and younger, really don't have that awareness at all. And despite that, there are still thousands of nuclear weapons in the world that are pointed at various targets. I mean, I guess I'm fishing around for a question. It occurs to me that what we need more authors writing about nuclear weapons to make our population aware of the threat. Would you agree with that?
I guess, you know, I would. I mean, it's, in some circles, people would say, oh, you know, this is far-fetched. You're not going to have terrorists gain access to these things. But it just doesn't seem that far-fetched to me. And, you know, my kids are not growing up at a time when we are constantly focused on that. It's only been in very recent, the last year or two, that we've been afraid of what North Korea might do. We haven't really thought to ourselves, okay, we're at such tensions with the Russians that they could launch on us at any point, which that wasn't the case when I was growing up. We were that nervous about it. It was really something that was part of the psyche of the country. So, you know, yeah, I think people being more aware of it would help.
Do you think it's our top threat that we face, or are you more afraid of other things?
I think that it is very tough for terrorists, like you said, terrorists to get a hold of one of these weapons. So I think that we are always on guard. We're always fearful that something will slip through, and it will happen. And if it does happen, they only have to get it right that one time. They can try and try. They can get it wrong. Just if they get it right one time, then we've really suffered a loss. So I think that there's a lot of other threats. I think there's a lot of easier ways to commit terroristic acts than really creating a weapon and detonating it somewhere.
So you've already demonstrated that you're brave by taking on a strong female character. nuclear weapons is a highly technical topic. So how did you conduct your research? You know, what sort of doubts do you have to work through? You know, because you're never going to get it. I mean, no one's going to tell you the answers, because that's classified, right? So you're not going to get everything right.
Correct. And you have to just, you know, I don't have a background in nuclear physics, for example. So I have to really just partly use my imagination. And then once my imagination has taken over and taken me down a path, then I can say, all right, is that possible? So let's go out and look, you know, in Protocol 15, how large of a physical object are we talking about here? You know, how would they get it out? So some of this is just maneuvering. How would you actually get your hands on these things? How would you get, and what expertise would be required? Let's say you now have the top section of an intercontinental ballistic missile, which contains all the nuclear components, well, how would you know how to get it out? And so what expertise would be required? So in my book, it's not as though I go into, you know, the minutia of, you know, how, you know, you would actually separate these weapons, but I do bring in real experts who would have had a background who would know how to do that. So the terrorist doesn't always have to know everything themselves either.
Have you had chats with nuclear experts in the research for your books?
There are a couple. And usually I just send one or two people an excerpt. You know, here's a section I wrote and I've researched it. But, you know, what do you think? And what's fun, Natasha, is that you're one of them.
Yes, I know.
So it's always been great. You know, it was great to have met you, to be able to put that together, to say, oh, wow, this is perfect. When I have a plot and when I have a weapon, you know, Natasha can kind of steer me and guide me and help me stay on track there.
Yeah, because I'm looking for experts, more expert than myself, I guess, when I'm searching for answers. So let's talk a little bit about pop culture, because we talked about the past, the threat of the Soviet Union, the fact that past generations are much more in tune with the threat, with the existence of nuclear weapons. I teach a course on WMD and film. The reason I do that is because we're lucky that WMD hasn't been used that often. But on the flip side, it's really difficult to understand these abstract threats if you haven't seen it. And so I use film to teach in the classroom and give people some sort of visual for their imagination so they can understand the extent of threats. And so we watch a lot of movies. And I'm just curious, do you have any favorite movies on nuclear weapons?
Well, I think one of the ones that always stood out in my mind was The Hunt for Red October. And that was always, you know, it was fascinating to me because just the whole premise of there being a submarine that was so quiet that its only purpose could possibly be to sneak up on an enemy like the United States and launch, and it would be too late because they're so close. And that was a big, exciting plot and premise. And the other thing that always stood out about that particular story to me was that story Tom Clancy created based on inspiration from true events. So it's not that he knew about some secret Russian sub that was very quiet, but I can distinctly remember in high school, the news media reporting on a Russian submarine, a nuclear sub that had gone down and it was missing and they were looking for it and they were frantic. And we were offering to help and things like that. And it was just it was a frightening thing. Well, Clancy just took that initial thought process and just spun it into this huge novel. So I was like that.
Is that why you wrote about a sub in your novel?
It definitely had an influence. I didn't really want to write a full submarine novel. That wasn't the point. And in Protocol 15, for example, is not a story about a sub, but there is a big sub series that goes throughout that particular opening anyway. So, but yeah, that was always interesting. My father was not a submariner, but he did spend a little time on a submarine. And I was able to find an expert who had just retired from the Navy, from the submarine service. So that was quite helpful to get some of those details really ironed out.
Well, an idea came to mind about a plot that might interest you, and I'll just throw it out there because I like to see these plots turn into stories, and I don't have all this time on my hands.
Right.
A future hunt for Red October would be using underwater drones to track down and hunt submarines underwater. And it's anyone who knows something about deterrence understands how important nuclear submarines are to deterrence. So the concept of deterrence is that the threat of retaliation prevents someone from launching a nuclear attack in the first place. But it's unstable if both sides could potentially take out the forces of the other side with one strike. because that would give them a first strike advantage. And so there would be a temptation to just take the other side's nuclear weapons out. Nuclear submarines, when they came on board in the 1960s, provided second strike capability. And the idea was you couldn't find them, you couldn't hit them with a nuke because they were secret underwater. And so it was a retaliatory capability that was guaranteed. It was reliable. And you would take the subs and you would hit cities in retaliation for any sort of nuclear attack. The problem with taking drones and putting them underwater and even being able to swarm drones, making them autonomous, is you could potentially undermine that second strike capability and create instability. So it's a great kind of like complex state actor, potentially non-state actor plot that I've been thinking about a lot lately. And just another interesting tidbit, if you haven't read about it, Russia is developing an autonomous drone that could potentially launch your nuclear weapon. It's in the bluster and the open sources you can read about it. And that, as you said about the hunt for Red October, the submarine getting so close to the United States and being able to launch an attack, think about an autonomous drone.
Right. You don't even have to have people. Right. Very scary, but that's a great plot. That's a great plot for a book. Is if you could, if they could find the subs that are out there, you could certainly take them out with a number of drones.
Yeah, and maybe it's not even taking them out, but just knowing where they are could potentially undermine that strategic relationship between two nuclear weapon states. So are you working on the next book of the Jana Baker series?
Well, Jana does make an appearance in the next book that I'm about to release. This book is called Flight of the Skyhawk. And it's also inspired by true events. And I took a true event from history and that has to do with a nuclear weapon and brought it out and used it as the story. So she does make a strong appearance in this next book, but she's not the star of the next book. But Flight of the Skyhawk is based on a true story that in 1965 on one of our U.S. carriers, we had an accident which occurred in which a fighter bomber plane, a Skyhawk, actually fell off of the carrier. So it was being loaded onto the elevator. Something went wrong. It rolled completely off the back of the elevator. Pilot, plane dumped overboard. The pilot was killed. Plane was never recovered. And on top of that, there was a nuclear weapon on the plane. Because again, this is 1965. You think about your history. This is Cold War. Tensions with Russia were very high. We would tend to take small tactical nuclear weapons and put them onto airplanes and keep them in the air when we were particularly tense. And that's where accidents happen. And this one happened. And unfortunately, that pilot was lost and that weapon was never recovered in 3.5 miles of ocean depth. So that's where the story starts.
And that's a fascinating example. When I teach my class on WMD, we talk about nuclear deterrence. And in the very first lecture, my students, who mostly come from the military and the civilian sector at a senior level, lieutenant, colonel, they come in fairly confident about deterrence and how it works because it worked so well during the Cold War. And then I show them a documentary, and you might be interested. There's a couple of Sandia documentaries called Always Never. If you put it in YouTube, they're very well done that talk through the history of U.S. nuclear weapons policy, the history of the PAL, the permission action links, which were the locks that they put on nuclear weapons. So if you got a hold of a weapon, you still needed a code, which only came about in the 1960s, by the way. But there is also very good coverage of many of the accidents, the nuclear accidents, so the lost nuclear weapons. And we had a number of very interesting incidents, one even a number of over the United States, over the state of Georgia. There was one over Spain. We had a bomber crash into a radar that could have looked like a nuclear attack. And so when my students watch these documentaries, I also show them a number of films, and we talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We talk about another incident that nearly happened in 1983 with Abel Archer. There was a Russian lieutenant colonel who basically saved us, saved the world, by recognizing that the 5 nuclear weapons coming from the U.S. to attack the Soviet Union was a false alarm. So basically saw 5 nuclear weapons headed for the Soviet Union, and he decided that that wasn't possible because if the U.S. decided to launch, they weren't going to launch 5. They were going to launch 1,000.
That's right.
And so he actually did not activate the next level. So he would have had to report that incident to his leadership, and then they would have potentially launched a counterattack on the United States. That alarm came in not once, but I believe at least twice. And both times he rejected that alarm and did not act. He was then eventually fired for saving the world. but I love it that you kind of took the inspiration from one of these mishaps and, you know, kind of created a story out of it. So when is this one coming out? This new book?
It will actually, by the time this podcast goes live, it will be on pre-order. Again, it's called Flight of the Skyhawk. And I think the pre-order will say something like end of March, but the actual book will probably come out a few weeks from now. So it'll be much quicker.
Great. So with this podcast, I'm hoping to build resources for authors who want to write about weapons of mass destruction and emerging technologies. We're not going to ignore future threats. Do you have any suggestions or special requests? Now is your opportunity to ask me to interview so-and-so.
You know, I think one thing that would help is some of us are just, we're just looking for the basics and don't necessarily always know where to start. It could just be that you create a nice FAQ to start with that just goes over, here are some of the basics. And it could even include the difference between fission and fusion, so you don't get those confused. You know, what's possible? Things like blast radius. So if you have a nuclear weapon, what size is it and what's the blast radius? What does that translate to? And across that blast radius, what kind of damage are you looking at? Because on the edges, you may not see the same damage as in the center. So, you know, what's the result? So I think that would help. And then also maybe part of that FAQ would be pointing authors at certain sites that might provide more detailed information. Like I had asked you in the past about what are the methods that we today could detect nuclear material? So what can we do on the borders? What kind of technologies are out there? And even if they're experimental. So, and you help point me in a direction. So if there's resources like that, that would help.
Well, actually, I'm going to address the basics. So in addition to interviewing authors on this podcast, I'll be interviewing subject matter experts. So I have a friend from the FBI WMD Directorate who will come on the podcast eventually and talk about what his office does and you know, how it works. And that will kind of give authors a kind of insider's view on the WMD Directorate at the FBI. I'm also planning on doing what I call 101 modules. And I'm going to start out with nuclear weapons, so you should be excited about that. And so basically, I'm going to do nuclear 101. I've already created an outline of the kind of basic topics. And basically, I'm going to do maybe 20, 30-minute episodes on each of those and then do a write-up online as well and link to resources that I would recommend. So hopefully that is a useful resource in the future.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. We could use the help.
Great. So why don't you tell my listeners where we can find you online and all of the details you want to talk, give them about your books?
Sure. You can find information on all my books at nathanagoodman.com, and that should take care of it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I really enjoyed our discussion.
All right, Natasha, thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review. You can also support my time in producing the show with Patreon at www.patreon.com/Natasha Bajima. For more information about the podcast, go to www.authorsofmassdestruction.com. See you next week!